On today's episode, the seeds of culture, so that you can bring a positive change to your organization. Are you a leader trying to get more from your business and life?
Me too.
So join me as I document the conversations, stories, and advice to help you achieve what matters in your life. Welcome to Unbound with me, Chris Dubois. Dan Bredesen is the founder of Leadfront Consulting, where he consults businesses on organizational culture and leadership. With over 20 years of experience, Dan has held leadership positions with Fortune 500 companies and several nonprofit organizations. Dan is the author of The Seeds of Culture, and we are going to explore that deeper today. Dan, welcome to Unbound.
Hi, well, thank you for having me, Chris. It's good to be here. Probably hear that from everybody, though, right?
Yeah, everybody says it. Usually, I wait for the follow-up afterwards if people are like, hey, thanks again.
Yeah.
All right, get it off.
No. Has he ever had anyone come on here and, you know, it's really not a pleasure to be here? I don't
really. Yeah, just I can't believe you asked me.
All right. What am I doing here? No, yeah. It is for real. It's glad we're able to connect again.
Yeah, and I'm excited for this episode, which, I mean, we'll get into it since we get into the questions, but why don't we start with your origin story?
Right. So, because it is, I guess it's, I'm going to start at the very beginning, since we're doing an origin story. It's not as cool as like Wolverine or like Deadpool's origin story, but it is my story nonetheless, so I know how it goes. Because it does kind of feed into the book that I wrote and some of the ideas that I have around organizational culture and leadership. I grew up on a small dairy farm in Southwest Wisconsin, and grew up as a farm kid. Ended up going to University of Wisconsin, got a degree from there. Didn't really know what I wanted to do with it, but went abroad for a while. Lived and worked in London for about 7 months. Came back, still didn't really know what I wanted to do, but someone had said, hey, you know, think you'd be pretty good if you got into sales. So went and got a job in sales. It happened to be in the insurance and financial services industry, which is not something that a person normally wakes up, you know, when they're 8 years old and said, I can't wait to go out there and sell insurance. That's not one of the, I wanted to pitch for the Milwaukee Brewers, man, but my fastball couldn't get a speeding ticket in a school zone. So I got into sales and turned out that I was pretty good at it. And it just so happened that the type of products that we were selling and the market in which we were selling those products was business to business. So I wasn't like sitting at someone's kitchen table and trying to, you know, sell them a life insurance policy at 8 o'clock at night. I was, working Monday through Friday, business to business, employee benefits, those type of things. So how did that give me some input and some guidance and insight into organizational culture? Well, the products that I was selling in the sales process started all the way in the C-suite, presidents, owners, CEOs, senior vice presidents of HR. And I'd often be sitting in boardrooms or in their office and we're talking about implementing a employee benefits plan for their employees and the subject of organizational culture or the type of culture that they had in that company would sometimes come up. Sometimes I'd see it, you know, painted on the walls in the lobby as I was sitting there waiting to go meet with them. So these senior leaders in an organization would tell me what they thought the culture of the organization was like. So, hey, when you go to implement these plans, you got to remember, you know, what the culture of our organization is like. Right, that's fine. And then I would work my way down through the organization, meeting with middle management, all the way down to talking to frontline employees, right? I was just there to talk to them about some insurance, but talking to frontline employees, and I'm there to talk about insurance. They're there to talk about everything else. Then I would hear everything about the company and the way that it was ran and how they would do things better. Or one of the first questions that I would ask when I would sit down and talk to an employee would be, so how long have you worked here? And they would tell me, I have been here 20 years. Well, why? I was just naturally curious, like what keeps you coming back to work here every day for 20 years? Or sometimes he'd be like, yeah, I worked here 6 months and it's 6 months too long. You know, well, why is that? Why don't you like working here? So in just going about my day-to-day sales job, I saw every different level of an organization, like each and every day, from the C-suite down to frontline employees. And, you know, just by asking these questions, like how long have you worked here? What do you like about working here? And why? I started to learn a lot about you know, the perceptions of what a culture is in an organization versus what it actually is. And like a lot of things is, if you're good at sales, they're often going to turn around and ask you to show other people how to sell. So I did that. So I was leading a small team, and then I was pretty good at that. So then I was leading a larger team, and then progressively larger teams, until finally I'm, you know, kind of removed from the sales process. Now it's just about leading a team. And I started thinking about, you know, what were all those lessons of culture that I learned along the way? Like, you know, those clients that I had that were, you know, really winning in both performance and with culture, what did they do that worked? The clients that I had that were, you know, losing, either culturally or financially, mm-hmm. well, what were they doing? Don't do that. And I tried to put some of that into the organizations that I led. And I eventually ended up going back and getting my master's degree in organizational leadership and learning. So that gave me sort of the academic flair for, you know, looking into it. I saw the very practical, you know, aspects of organizational culture. I took that with, you know, I did some research on organizational culture. I've always been fascinated by the intersection of leadership, culture, and an organization's performance. Did some research on that in grad school. And then I married that up with the beginning of our origin story, which is, you know, my growing up on my childhood, growing up on a farm, to kind of come up with a different paradigm with how leaders can think about the culture in their organization and how that ultimately impacts the way that they lead and the performance that organization is going to get. So that's the origin story.
All right. From a dairy farm to organizational culture building.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So I'm going to throw you for quick loop. I want to get into your book, but this is like a personal thing. Now I'm working on my definition for culture. Mm-hmm. And just trying to, like, because everybody has their own kind of take on it. I'm partial to Seth Godin, says, like, people like us do things like this. Mm-hmm. And just always resonated with me. But I'm curious what your definition for culture is, so that I can hopefully add it to my repertoire.
Sure. You know, it's not too far off of Seth Godin's. And I'll be real honest, it's nothing that I invented. It actually, there's a couple of organizational consultants back in the 80s, they came up with what I thought was the most succinct definition of culture out there. Because there's a lot packed into those seven letters. Because when you're talking about culture, you could be talking about, what are we talking about? It covers everything from religion to food to music to, you know, if someone just says culture, you know, languages, what exactly does that mean? You know, music, there's a musical mm-hmm. culture. So when it comes to organizational culture, what I hit upon for the book and as part of the definition is how we do things around here. So, and then those things are everything. So if someone is wondering what the culture is like in an organization, well, it's how we do things around here. And those things are everything from the way that we hire, the way that we promote, the way that we demote, the way that we fire, the way that we walk, the way that we talk, the way that we dress, the way that we talk to customers, the way that we talk to our peers, the way that it's the everything. It's how we do things. It's when you go to a new hire orientation, if you join a new, you know, a new organization, they're going to be telling you what we do around here. But then when you actually get outside of those four walls of the new hire orientation, and then you're interacting with all of your peers, that's when you're going to learn how we do things around here. They're going to tell you what we do. You're going to learn how we do it when you're actually interacting with your peers. So you said Godin's was like how people like us do things around here, something like that.
Yeah. People like us do things like this.
People like us do. So that, you know, very similar to this is how we do things around here. This is when you're in this group, this is how we do the things around here that need to get done.
Right. Yeah. I think a lot of it comes down to that standard that you set and that you hold everyone accountable to, because that becomes how you do the things.
Right.
So let's talk the seeds of culture. Mm-hmm. What are they?
So it took me a while to come to that, because when I first started, you know, listing out what the different seeds of culture were, well, let's actually back up for a second. where did I come up with this idea for seeds of culture? Where'd that name come up? It, in all of the interactions that I had, or many of the interactions that I had throughout my career, I noticed that there was a lot of organizations that were just kind of missing it, right? The way that they were going about the culture in their organization was just not really working, is it was leaders trying to build the culture of their organization. They would, the story of a failing organization, it's a pretty common story, meaning that if performance is down, you know, what typically happens in the organization? Do they fire every employee or do they bring in a new leader? Could be a sports team. It could be a nonprofit, could be a for-profit organization, whatever. If it's underperforming, they typically get rid of the new leader, get rid of the leader, bring in a new leader. And that new leader comes in and makes a lot of grandiose promises up to and including, we're going to build the culture around here. We're going to transform the culture. We're going to change the culture of this organization. So obviously there's sort of this tacit understanding that that culture impacts the performance of an organization, but they're often talking about it in construction terms. We need to build, transform, mold, change the culture. And you know, that can work for a while. They'll change the morale of the organization, but if they don't really address it properly, the old culture bubbles to the surface, underperformance happens again, and then we got to get another new leader in here. So it kind of struck me that the most successful leaders that I worked with treated it as an organic process. It was more about nurturing the culture. It was about growing culture. And anything that grows, I know from my days on the farm, but anyone kind of knows this, is that it's going to come from seeds. So what are the seeds of culture that are going to grow up into the type of culture that's going to impact the performance of an organization? So that's why there's seeds. And I started on the outline, I had about 20 of them. And like 20 different ideas of things to throw out there. Like, what are some good things that a cultural farmer can plant that are going to grow into a culture of commitment? And the way that I narrowed it down to the 7 seeds that I came up with is I did what I called the absence test, which was, in the absence of blank, are you going to get a culture of committed people? And if the answer was no, well, then that must be included as a seed of culture. So the first one is effective communication. And putting it to the absence test. In the absence of effective communication, are you going to get a culture of commitment? The answer is no. If you get really bad, crappy communication, you're not going to get a bunch of committed people. They're going to be wondering, you know, what's the real story? And effective communication I define in 3 ways, which is clarity, consistency, and transparency. If you're not clearly communicating, if you're not consistently communicating, if you're not you don't have transparency in your communication, then it's not going to fostering the type of culture that you want. The second one is ethics. Pretty self-explanatory. You can win financially in an unethical culture for a while on the short term, but you know, we don't need Woodward and Bernstein anymore in order to find companies that are unethical. It's, you know, someone with their cell phone can put it on the internet and you're going to be on blast before you know it. So you can't really hide your bad ethics for too long nowadays. So I know I wouldn't want to commit myself to an unethical organization, and most people are in the same boat. The third one is psychological safety, which is that is the ability to communicate and interact with your peers without fear of embarrassment or reprisal if you happen to make a mistake, and it's operating without fear. The fourth one is I call it diversity is a good start, meaning that diversity isn't just about checking boxes or having a diverse group on your team, which is very important. You also have to continue going towards until you get equity and then actually inclusive. Because when you have inclusion, then people are bringing them full selves to the organization. You're going to be able to service many more markets. It's just going to be a better organization for everybody. The next one is generosity. I found that the best leaders, the best culture farmers that I've run into are extremely generous, and that's going to foster a culture of commitment. Number 6 is autonomy, providing people the means to have a certain level of autonomy and feel like they have personal agency in where their career is taking them. If you can give them a bit of autonomy, they're going to be more committed to the organization. And then finally, it's mutual accountability, which is I refer to as the hybrid seed of culture, meaning that if you've got the other 6 working together, you're going to get this level of mutual accountability where the organization polices itself. If someone comes in who's counter to the culture that's been growing there, their peers are going to hold them accountable before the leader has to come in with any type of, like, you know, inspect what I expect type of accountability.
So. Right. Awesome. So I guess those are 7 things that everyone should be doing. What are how can like a leader come in, kind of identify some of those unhealthy aspects of their, you know, their culture?
The, so if you're trying to figure out, you know, what's kind of what needs changing, right? Or what are going to be the signs that maybe there's some cultural problems? Turnover is going to be a big one. I mean, maybe that's obvious, not so obvious, but you know, during the Great Resignation, a toxic culture was identified as the single biggest predictor of turnover. MIT did a study on it. It was interesting that, you know, we often think that people are going to leave one job and go to another strictly for compensation, but compensation ranks 16th on a list of reasons why people quit a job. Toxic culture is number one, compensation 16th. Actually, culture is 10 times more likely to predict turnover than compensation. So there's that. Absenteeism is another big sign that maybe there might be some cultural issues. Quiet quitting, that's been kind of a buzzword, you know, that's been going around. Not so much anymore. It's kind of funny how things like the Great Resignation and quiet quitting are like buzzwords when the economy is going like this and the job, it's a red hot job market. As the job market starts to slow down a little bit, there's less talk of that because there's less folks willing to quit their job if they're afraid they can't go find another one. But quiet quitting to me, it's really just employees who put no more effort into their jobs than absolutely necessary. Quiet quitting is doing just the bare minimum to keep you from getting fired. I would define that as really just a lack of commitment. Lack of commitment to the organization. So, but if you can you kind of sense that there are folks just doing the bare minimum in order to hold on to their job, that's a sign of some toxic culture. A lack of performance if the organization is starting to underperform. You know, this has been something that's been studied and known about since the 80s. There was two Harvard professors, Cotter and Heskett, that they found that good, strong, positive, culturally affirming organizations, you know, they had four times the revenue of organizations with a toxic culture. So it's been around for years. In 2020, MIT did they released their latest list of culture champions. And they found that folks that were on their list of culture champions, you know, they outperformed the S&P 500 by four times. They outperformed NASDAQ two times. Like they, if your organization is starting to underperform, it could be a cultural issue. Is there gossip? That's a good sign. Or I guess it'd be a bad sign. Or a good sign that there's a bad culture. How about that if there's gossip going throughout? And then another thing is a lack of what's called OCBs. And something that I touch on in the book, which is organizational citizenship behaviors. And OCBs would be going above and beyond, helping out your fellow coworker, staying a little bit longer, arriving a little bit earlier. Basically doing things going above and beyond to help the organization. So if you have a lack of OCBs, that's a good sign that you probably don't have a good culture in place.
Let's go. I've got so many questions here that I want to get into. I'm trying to figure out what would be the most valuable for everybody. I guess knowing all these things, knowing that you can have such a large financial impact just by paying attention to culture, what would you say is the quickest win, I guess, that someone could have? Like if they had to address one thing today, to just get it on track that would make everything else easy as far as culture building?
I would start with, and I would start with understanding that the leader needs to grow the culture, actually not build it. I would say if the leader can start with the mindset that there's not going to be a quick fix, but how about a place to start? And understanding that the growth of culture is going to take time, and a place for leaders to start would be starting today, start thinking about culture in terms of being a farmer and not a carpenter. Don't try to force culture into the organization. That was kind of the seed of an idea behind the whole book, was that an organic process is going to take time. But you can start by first being a good culture farmer. I mean that there are kind of six attributes that I have seen of successful, you know, culture farmers. So if you were to start today, I would probably start by accepting, if you're a leader, accepting the responsibility for the culture. It's not something that you can pass on to someone else. And here's an interesting thing, Chris, is I can't think of a single instance where I was working with an organization or was brought in by a leader of an organization that was underperforming. And I can't think of a single instance where I was brought in by an existing leader who pointed to culture as the problem. And I think that's because they kind of subconsciously understand that they are the ones responsible for where that culture is. So it's like if they throw the culture under the bus, they kind of understand that they're kind of throwing themselves under the bus. It's always someone else's fault, right? But one of the first things I get them to do is just accept responsibility for the culture. And first thing, you know, I call these the traits of successful culture farmers, is start to make it a priority. Start to talk about it. You know, when I would be sitting in those lobbies waiting to go talk to potential clients and I saw that the cultural values were on the wall, that's a good start, right? That's a good start, but it can't be where it ends either. Just putting it in your annual review or putting it on your website under the about section, or we believe this. Like, yes, if you're going to espouse those values, you got to make sure that you're living those values and making it a priority as well. I would ask leaders if they're looking for a place to start is, you know, what's your affinity for people? That's another one of the traits of successful culture farmers I've seen, which is, do you actually like people? You would think that liking people would be a prerequisite for leading people, but that's not always the case. I've run into plenty of leaders where I'm like, man, do you even like people? Like, what? Maybe you shouldn't have been in the people business. And I think it's, you know, they probably were very enthusiastic and loved everybody when they were first promoted, but cynicism can start to creep in when you start seeing people performing at their worst versus, you know, their best. So if you can just recognize that, hey, I need to maybe re-up my affinity for people, and really start by humbling yourself and going at it with an awful lot of humility and curiosity. There's been times in my career where maybe my affinity was wavering. My affinity for people was, you know, wavering a little bit. And the organization I was leading, I can think of one time, we really got humbled by the marketplace. And I was like, I got to check myself here. What's going on? What am I doing in the organization? And kind of the marketplace bringing me down to earth and making me humble, it also made me curious about the folks that I had in the organization and learning more about them and where they're coming from, what their goals are. So that would be the second thing that I would say. Maintaining your authenticity. You know, people are looking for real things. But with all that hustle and grind culture that we got out there, and there's so many people out there trying to be influencers for this and that, it's really easy for leaders to end up as just some kind of fake version of, you know, some hybrid of this person they saw on Instagram and this other person that they follow on LinkedIn. Like, you know, be yourself, you know, be the best version of yourself, but really, you know, be authentic. Credibility, you know, do you, if we're looking at things we can look at today, is, do you have any blind spots? And do you have you put anyone into a leadership position who maybe wasn't ready and you didn't do anything to help get them ready? You know, if you promote someone, the entire organization is looking at you if you promote someone too early. Make sure that you're always bringing value as well. I have, another part of being a good culture farmer is integrity. So I put credibility and integrity together like this for culture farmers, in that credibility is the reason why people will start listening to you, and integrity is the reason why they'll continue listening to you. If you don't have any credibility, people are going to be asking themselves, well, why am I listening to Dan? Why am I listening to Chris? Right. But if you can find ways to always bring value to every interaction that you have with them, that's going to be making deposits into your credibility bank. Now, if you lie to them, if you don't follow up on your word, or you promote someone who really shouldn't have been promoted, well, that's going to be withdrawals from your credibility bank. And then when, you know, integrity is pretty self-explanatory, you know, I remember one of the earliest definitions I saw for integrity was doing the right thing even while no one's watching. Which is good. That's fine. I prefer to think about integrity as doing the right thing because everyone's watching. As a leader, you're on a pedestal. People are watching every decision. that you make, everything that you say. So that's why it's really important to do the right thing, because everyone is watching, and that's going to impact your credibility as well. And then finally is just maintaining the energy to be a good leader. So if you're trying to get something started, I guess this is a long-winded answer to your question, which is, you know, where do you start today? You start on yourself, right? And making sure that you have the energy in order to go through this cultural growth, this farming of culture. I break energy down into three things. There's the mental energy, which is always keep learning. You know, you're never through learning. I believe it was attributed to Kennedy, something along the lines of that, the leader who is through learning, or the leader who's finished learning is finished, kind of thing. The physical energy to maintain, you know, the physical energy to do this work, you know, it can be exhausting. And also the emotional energy. Emotional energy is, you know, it's a combination of resilience and optimism. Can you maintain your optimism? That's kind of your emotional offense, and your emotional defense is going to be your resiliency. How resilient are you, and how can you bend without breaking, so to speak?
Right. Yeah, everybody needs that optimism. Yeah. So why would you follow a leader without it? So we talked ownership being that critical piece, and that's something I saw in the Army quite a bit, the people that took ownership of their culture, because it is truly the one thing the leader owns, right, in the organization, that culture. And you could see, right, the ones who took ownership of that culture really made that organization stand out, because they took it personal when things weren't going well. Right. They wanted to fix it. Now, in a larger organization, you get like subcultures, mm-hmm, right? Where it's, you know, we got the sales team, we got the marketing team. How do you kind of maintain that ownership, knowing that each of those individual cultures is going to change a bit because of who's leading those organizations? So like, do you have some, I don't know, an approach, like for kind of making sure the organization as a whole is still kind of in line with that while still letting people foster that smaller group, you know, kind of, I don't want to call it tribalism, but
no,
you know what I'm saying?
No, the subcultures are probably the most organic part of the larger culture. And studies have shown that the subcultures have a larger impact on a person's commitment to the organization than even the larger, broader culture. So it's something that to be aware of. And best way to describe that is that, you know, your particular department supervisor might be awesome, even if the boss that they report to sucks. You know, that person might be a jerk, but, you know, maybe you have a great leader of your particular department who does a good job of buffering, you know, buffering the corporate BS that may be coming down, or vice versa. Maybe you've got a great CEO who's out there, but, you know, your direct supervisor is a real jerk. That's going to impact. It doesn't matter how great the CEO is. If you're the person how often are you actually going to interact with the CEO? Like never, you know, it's not like they're walking by your desk every day, patting you on the back. If your direct daily supervisor is a jerk, that's really going to impact your level of commitment to the organization. So what leaders can do is simply be aware that there are going to be subcultures that come up. It's really more about disabling negative subcultures than encouraging positive ones. You know, because they're going to come up on their own. They're going to happen. I would also question have you really planted the seed of diversity if you don't get subcultures? If you don't have folks who are, you know, if everyone walks, talks, and acts the same, then how diverse really is that organization? How do you really have psychological safety in that organization if people aren't a little bit different? I have led the island of misfit toys on more than one occasion in my career. It's the team that's a little bit more quirky. I'd like to say that we had the most fun, but it's going to be there. There's, you know, if it gets out of, you know, too negative or too far outside the bounds of how we do things around here, then the mutual accountability that has grown will take care of it.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I guess at what size do you think an organization starts to have subcultures, and how large do those subcultures have to become before they're, you know, something to pay attention to?
That's a great question. I don't know if you can put a
number. Yeah, it's hard to quantify.
Yeah, right. It's hard to quantify that. The number that popped in my head is that when you get three or four people together in any one particular team, they're going to start you know, taking on a life of their own. What, from your experience in the Army, what, where would you put the number?
Yeah, I was going to say about 3 to 4. We do. So there's the span of influence, or span of control rather, when, in the Army, where we'll never have more than 3 to 5 units within the like command of the next higher echelon. And so, you know, you'll have 3 to 4 dudes who are in a team, and then you'll have 2 teams in a squad, and then 4 squads in a platoon. And so you're always trying to maintain that kind of size to keep things small. But you can see even at a team level within a platoon that like one team might do things way different than another team, even though your 36 guys are all interacting together on a daily basis. It's like just that small group is able to kind of take on a life of its own, which is interesting.
And yeah, to be able to see it. I thought the kind of the military number I'd heard, and obviously I wasn't in the military, so you know better than I do, was like 6, you know, or maybe someone just told me that, like, don't have more than 6 direct reports, because then it gets kind of hard to, you know, hard to manage.
Maybe in the Navy, because they're all on the boat. It's easy, right? You don't have to run very far. You just have to get to one end of the ship to the other. Span of control for the, at least in the Army, 3 to 5.
Yeah.
Usually 4. 4 is like that magic number.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know where I'd heard that, but it kind of made sense to me, because in my head, I was thinking of it in terms of like, you know, if there's 8 hours in a day, they're supposed to be working, like you can kind of devote like 1 hour to each person and then a couple extra hours on yourself. I don't know, but that was just how the oversimplification in my head. But yeah, it's, if you have 12 direct reports, things start to get a little squirrely. That's a technical term for you there.
Hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, definitely. You start losing, like you just can't pay attention to everything at once. So
yeah, that's where they get the, is that how people get in trouble with their lack of institutional control? And then that's how college coaches always get fired, because it just, there's lack of institutional control. Like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. So let's start. We have now moved into a remote environment, a hybrid environment, if you will. I've ran an organization that was completely remote prior to COVID. So it was a little different as far as like, no one was shifting to learning the new way of doing things. But like, I guess organizations that do have to do this, where you can't see everybody every day and you're not necessarily building these connections and doing those things, what advice would you have for those organizations as they try to grow their culture and into something that actually flourishes when they, you know, don't have immediate access to everybody continuously?
Yeah, it's interesting, because a few years ago, if someone said, oh, that company's got a great culture, I mean that they had like bean bags and craft beer on tap in the break room, you know, it meant that you could bring your dog to work. That was the definition of culture, was, oh, this is so cool, we play ping pong on our breaks. You know, well, COVID kind of took that away, didn't it? No one's showing up the office. Doesn't matter what all the great perks are while you're there, if no one's showing up anyways. And I think kind of brought it back to, What do people really value? I got a whole chapter kind of on the Great Resignation and what that meant from a cultural perspective. And it's really, for me, the Great Resignation is 2 things. It was, you could call it the Great Resignation, or it could be just the Great Correction. Could be the labor market correcting itself after the world opened back up, or the Great Epiphany, meaning that when people were sent home to work from home and they didn't have to commute anymore and they got more time with their family, they had this epiphany that, oh, I kind of like this. I would prefer to work remote. From a cultural perspective, I say this, is that by the definition of culture being how we do things around here, all of those things still need to get done, whether I'm showing up at work or whether I'm working at home. You know, I worked in a remote environment for a while, and I got onboarded remotely. I worked with all of my peers remotely. Is it easier or harder to make a connection with a person? It's probably a little harder remotely. So you may have to go out of your way to make a connection. One thing that I appreciated about the organization that I worked with was they made an effort for us to get together like once a quarter. And that was about all I wanted, because you'll often hear folks complain about when they're working remotely that lack of personal connection. I don't see everybody so much or whatever. you can't have it both ways, meaning that you can't enjoy working from home and then complain that you don't get to go to the office. Which one is it? So what's the happy medium? I found that for me, and this is just me, my sweet spot was seeing my peers about once a quarter. Maybe that could be once a month. So if a leader's looking at it like, all right, how could we, within budget, get folks together in a frequent enough time that they're going to feel this connection with everybody versus, you know, forcing them back to the office. I'm sorry. The term is welcoming them back to the office. They are invited to return to the office. When folks are forced back to the office, it just breeds resentment because they got so used to working remote. But now if you're going to invite them back, then, you know, say, well, you got to come in 2 days a week. Now it's three. Now it's four. You can find that happy medium. I would say if you can find a way for folks to get together face-to-face once a month to once a quarter, that's going to kind of allay those fears of, or those concerns of, I don't have a good connection with the folks. And you may think that, well, that doesn't seem like much, once a quarter, you know, or even once a month. Think about how fast a month flies by. We're busy doing all of the things that we need to be doing. We got family obligations. We got work obligations. If you want to create some connections, that's about how frequently I would suggest getting folks together, if that's a concern.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. All right, Dan, lots of awesome tips, wins, approaches for getting culture
packed
into this episode. I think you delivered on the, credibility and integrity side of this.
Thank you.
So I want to get into three kind of final questions here.
Sure.
With the first being, separate from your book, what book do you recommend everyone should read?
There's one that's on my desk right now. Whenever there's like a change movement going on, one that I pulled off my shelf recently, it's called Leading Change by John Cotter. I mean, it's probably close to 30 years old now, but it's been updated a few times. It really is kind of a step-by-step process for any type of organizational change, you know, even addresses like cultural things that have to happen. So I'll give you two. Have you ever read the Four Disciplines of Execution? 4DX. That's another good one. That's good when you need to like tactically like execute on something right now. The idea being that strategy is knowing what to do. Execution is knowing how to do it. And so they've got a very tactical, regimented process for how to get an organization to execute on something. And it's not dissimilar from, you know, leading change and kind of leading a change initiative that you need to make. There's an 8-step process that Cotter lays out. It's a pretty famous one. And then the 4DX has been very good because it's like super tactical on what to do to get an organization to execute.
Awesome. All right. I got to check both of those out. So what is next for you professionally?
I'm starting to do more keynotes and things like that. Been in, had a few organizations invite me in to kind of deliver a keynote message and then, you know, stay behind and work with the team. So I'm getting into doing some more of that. And that's kind of a keynote and followed up with workshopping and leading discussions afterwards for senior leaders and organizations.
Awesome. And finally, where can people find you?
Find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on danbredeson.com, danbredeson.com. That's how you can get in contact with me or hit me up on LinkedIn or Instagram, danbredesonauthor.com. Check me out there. The book's available anywhere that you buy books. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble. That probably the greatest achievement in my daughter's eyes was that the book was available at her favorite store, Target. So and now daddy had made the big time, you know.
Right.
So Seeds of Culture is a book, and it's available anywhere you buy books.
Awesome. All right. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, it's thanks for having me. That was a lot of fun. Appreciate it.
Was it like a legit thanks for having me?
It is.
All right.
This was good. I liked the first conversation that we had, and then this was just a continuance of that. So I appreciate it.
If you enjoyed today's episode, I would love a rating and review on your favorite podcast player. And for more information on how to build effective and efficient teams through your leadership, visit leadingforeffect.com. As always, deserve it.